We are back on the Fan Morning Show, Sportsnet 590, The Fan, Justin Cuthbert and Ailish Forfar on the other side of the OG A-list. My favorite A-list. And we got our,
you know.
We got our favorite Leafs reporter here at Sportsnet on the line, Luke Fox, Sportsnet NHL reporter who wrote a great piece on Sheldon Keefe and Sheldon Keefe's season. Luke, we just did our grades for different categories for the Leafs, you know, standard stuff, forwards, defense, coaching. We both gave an A- to Sheldon Keefe. What would your grade for the Leafs coach be?
Yeah, that's about right. I think I have to agree with you. I know it doesn't make for good radio when everyone agrees on the same topic.
We've been told that before.
So I was tempted to argue just for argument's sake. But, yeah, no, I think that's about right because I think he's done an excellent job. The team is absolutely rolling right now, but not a perfect job, right? Like, the rocky start, there were some questions on how he was handling it. Do you slam your team after the very first game at the Bell Center in Montreal? That was a bit of a shocker. And later he actually wondered publicly, you know, if he should have used one of those bullets. But I also think that moment kind of let his team know and let the world know how serious he was about getting them to play the right way. And when I say that, I mean really drilled down defensively. And he set that tone right from the beginning in training camp and, you know, definitely made a point of making that a big deal in the first game, even though it was only the first game of the season and mistakes are to be expected. But it seems to be paying off right now because there were so many people that would have said, okay, you lose TJ Brody, Morgan Rielly, Jake Muzzin off your blue line. You call up guys, some of whom have never played in the NHL or have barely played for your team. How are they going to get the job done? And now he's coming back from a road trip where they went 4-0 in the Mac Hollowell era, and everyone's kind of shaking their head. But the players absolutely deserve credit for, you know, an all hands on deck approach, and the forwards too, you know, making defense priority number one. But I think a lot of that is Keith, and I think he deserves a lot of credit for getting that buy-in, especially when there were moments there. It feels like a long time ago, but it wasn't that long ago where, you know, maybe a month ago, people were wondering, is this guy on the hot seat? You know, is his job in danger if things keep going the way they were going on the California road trip a few weeks back? So I think he deserves a lot of credit and praise for turning this thing around. And that's why I wanted to write about it too, because yes, obviously Mitch Marner right now is the story, right? The guy's on fire. He's making magic happen out there. And there's other good stories like Mark Giordano stepping up his minutes and Austin Matthews is starting to find his groove. There's a lot of positive things, but I think you need to step back. And if we're going to rip the coach or criticize the coach, we need to give him some praise when praise is due. And I think the work he's done over the past month is really phenomenal.
You borrowed a phrase from John Tortorella. Keith is jamming it to his critics. That's what he says. Tortorella said he hoped that he jammed it to us. And I guess that's exactly what we're seeing. But, you know, the story of the season for Keith is, you know, that early season rocky road that you laid out where it seemed like there was a disconnect between him and the players. It seemed like there was a possibility of him losing the room. And yet it seems like he's broken. Broken through to the team, that he's gotten through to them however way he's done that. How do you think that process played out? Like, was there serious disconnect? Was there, you know, the room sort of in and out, like half in, half out? And how do you think, other than just the injuries and the attention to detail that was required, how do you think he did get to the team, if that was indeed the case?
I don't think he ever lost the room. At the time, you know, my argument was more about I think he was dealing with a flawed roster. And I still have some questions about the bottom six and, if the defense is fit for playoffs. But right now, you know, you're not going to rip on the team. But I never thought he lost the room. You know, I think there was probably a little too much made of, you know, when he sat Mitch Marner for one shift. I think that there was some weakness shown or some, you know, I don't know. I think he was right to be questioned by when he called out his elite players after the one game. And I had no problem with that. I think he should have called them out. They weren't playing well at the time. But then when he kind of softened it and walked it back, I think that's where a lot of the criticisms start, because people were kind of wondering, okay, well, who's in control here? But I never got the sense that the players stopped trying or they were trying to get him fired or anything like that. It didn't feel the same way as when they had basically quit on Babcock and mm-hmm. Babcock had lost the room. I never got that sense. I just thought the pieces weren't working together. There was this bad disconnect on the ice between the defense and the forwards. Breaking out of their own zone seemed to be a big issue. And it took a while for some of their best players to find their game. And I think the way that the team is built, you need those guys up and humming. And that was part of it. And now they are. They're the only team in the whole league that has four guys with 25 points. Now, the drop-off after that is pretty significant. But I think the losing was frustrating, guys. I think Austin Matthews was used to, you know, shooting in the net pretty much every single night. He gets off to a slow start. Marner's having some issues, you know, the public benching. I think it took a toll on him mentally. So I think everyone was kind of going through their own thing of, this is supposed to be easy. We're supposed to be this, you know, powerhouse in the league, and they're kind of stumbling their way through for 3-4 weeks. But I never got the sense that it was like, oh, we're blaming the coach. I think there was just frustration all around, and it contributed to a down mood amongst the team, and it took them a while to find their groove, and now they're there.
Does the Leafs leadership group, or, you know, those with a letter on their jersey or not, have much to play into this? Anything in terms of credit that they should deserve as well with the way that Keefe has been able to kind of turn this team around, as you said, from the road trip from hell?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, they deserve credit. I mean, the best thing they could do, quite honestly, is play better and, you know, drag other people to play better alongside them. And I actually think, you know, if we go through the list, I think John Tavares is having a really fine and consistent season. He's never going to be that rah-rah guy, but his performance has been very steady. Mitch Marner is the one that is spiked the most and right now looks like one of the best players in the whole world. So I think that has a lot to do with it. I think Mitch's mood has a lot to do with things. You know, he's never going to be John Tavares. He's never going to be Mr. Even Keel. When things are going sour, you're going to know by being in his presence. I mean, there was one practice when, shortly after that, it may have been the very first practice in Toronto after that road trip from hell, when the reporters walked in and he referred to the group as, something along the line of, here come the piranhas. You know, and it wasn't all lighthearted, you know. But then when things are going great, he'll be laughing and joking with you. I mean, he's a guy who has more pronounced energy swings than a Tavares. And I don't think that's a bad thing. I think it's good to have different personalities. And I think it's very contagious when he's in a good mood. And I think that's spreading through the group. And I think, Ailish, when you mentioned like the guys in the letters have an effect, I think Mitch playing well makes him feel well, and I think that's contagious throughout the group. So I think that's had a very positive effect. And I think Austin, you know, isn't publicly hard on himself, but I think he has a high internal standard. So, you know, you can see it in his goal celebrations. I think the fact that the goals are starting to come, the points are starting to come, you know, he's finding his rhythm a bit more. I think that is really important too. You want your best players feeling good. Things are trending in the positive direction, but I do think it's never one thing, right? It's not just Sheldon Keefe. It's the players and the leaders. Absolutely. But I just think not enough had been written about the job Keefe had done. So that's why I chose to write about that yesterday.
That's interesting on Marner. I mean, our take yesterday was not that the Leafs run on confidence, which it seems that they do, but that they run on Mitch Marner's confidence. Is that exactly what we're seeing right now? And based on what you said there, just how, you know, it kind of, his mood is very, very reflected on what's going happen, what's happening and what it feels like in that room. It feels like that's the case.
Well, he's a big presence in that room. Like, he's joking and laughing and chirping, and often he's the one playing the music. I do think he has influence on the temperature of a room, and that can be a very positive thing. And I think it can have somewhat of a reverse effect if things are going sour. This is a wild town to play in. Like, it is a roller coaster, and we contribute to it too, right? Like, but I think it all stems from how they're playing on the ice. You know, if they're playing good hockey, the articles are going to be positive. The chatter around the team is going to be positive, and that kind of, I think, contributes to it. You know, the fans are into it. The fans are cheering it. All of it is kind of like this ecosystem that feeds off one another. And there were moments when things were going south where they got booed off the ice. Power play got booed off the ice a couple of times. Justin Hall got some boos. You know, this is an emotional place to play. And Mitch, more than anyone, you know, lives it. I don't think it's an accident that Austin Matthews invited this guy out, has been trying to, well, he tried two summers ago, but the wrist surgery set those plans back, but he did get Marner and Bunting as well out of town. And I don't think that's an accident. I think he wants Mitch to get out of the Toronto bubble every once in a while and clear his head, you know, because I think it's a lot for a hometown kid. And credit to him though, like, he's pushed through a lot, and is dragging this team right now. Like, he's leading them on the ice. He has been for about 3 weeks now.
That ecosystem comment's interesting because I feel like these guys are certainly smart enough, but the Piranhas comment, like, if things aren't going well and they want to deflect attention, that's a way to do it, right? Like, if it's all about the fan base talking about you and you make it so that the fan base starts talking about the media, maybe a little pressure off there.
There's this thing, and I think it started, I don't know when it started exactly, but I felt like it started after the Montreal loss. That year, the collapse, because the fan base took it hard. You know, you collapse like that to a lower seed. If you're in the media, you can take a swing at them, right? Because that's a series they should absolutely win. Injuries be damned. And I felt like after that, the summer they came back, there was this feeling I sensed that it was kind of us against the world. You guys don't get it. We're going to prove you wrong. We're the only ones who still believe in us, and we're going to do it for us. And there was a bit of a barrier feeling going up. And, you know, athletes, you know, they need to find their motivation wherever they can find it. And if that's what they need to do and feel like we're going to prove the haters or the doubters wrong, and you'll see, this is the right group. And I think that actually stems from the top on down, right? Like, Kyle Dubas running it back. I'm not going to make changes. You'll see, this vision will work. And the jury's still out, right? Like, no, I don't think anyone's ever questioned that this is a good team. But there is a little bit of a sentiment of, we have to depend on ourselves. If anyone's going to do this, we have to prove it to ourselves, because on the outside, there's too many doubters, and sometimes they're not on our side. They're only on our side when it's going well. So we got to figure this out. I do sense that at times.
If we're looking at Sheldon Keefe's just over three seasons since he joined the Maple Leafs, would the split of Matthews and Marner on two different lines be his best decision or best call as a coach that you've seen yet?
Yeah, I really like it. And I wonder if he wanted to do it earlier and hesitated. There was definitely some people, you know, fans calling for it earlier. Like, when things are going well, it seems like the silliest thing to do is just to stick with the same plan. But it's a big decision. And, you know, for one, you got your Hart winner, Rocket winner, Ted Lindsay winner, and who's his favorite playmaker? Mitch Marner, right? So it's not as small as flipping Yarncroc and Kerfoot on some line or dropping down bunting. It's a bigger decision. It has bigger implications. And everyone knows kind of when you step back, you want to keep Austin Matthews happy because he's the one that's going to decide whether he wants to put his signature on a piece of paper July 1st. So it gets a little bit complicated. And I'm sure that conversation isn't just between Sheldon Keefe and his assistants. I would imagine that's a bigger conversation to split up those two. Because heading into training camp, you know, the idea was asked, you know, do you think you might try mixing up at camp this year? And he was like, no, that was one of the best lines in hockey. That is our number one line. It's the rest we have to figure out. We got to find a left winger for Tavares and Nylander. But number one line, if anything's in stone, that's in stone. So that's how they came into it. But it got to the point where you couldn't deny that it needed a shakeup. I think at the time of the shakeup, Marner had not had a primary assist on an Austin Matthews goal at even strength. And that's a problem, right? Like that's showing you that it's not working. And maybe it's a wake-up call to the individuals. And maybe it's just a way to get the lines working better. And it's working. I mean, I don't think anyone thought for a second that Tavares and Marner would have chemistry. Tavares had his best year statistically in the league on the first year he got here, and his wingman was Marner. And then anytime Austin Matthews was out for a little bit with an injury, Tavares and Marner always kind of picked up. There's something about their games and Tavares's willingness to just kind of go to the net and Mitch's ability to find him anywhere that seems to work. And then when people are looking for that, it can go the other way. And Marner could maybe be the trigger man. So I really like those two together. What's promising to me is the fact that Matthews has found a way to produce with Nylander with bunting. I mean, that assist bunting had in the Pittsburgh game, where he's rushing down the wing, total effort on his side, gets the puck to Matthews. I think that's the most promising thing because the Marner Tavares connection to me was a given. So the fact that Matthews is starting to find some rhythm with Nylander and bunting, I think is really promising.
Yeah, it's obvious that it's working, and yet Sheldon Keefe still promises that it's temporary, right? Like, I think he's probably doing that to not create headlines, but, you know, there's several reasons, whether it's trying to keep everyone happy or trying to maybe validate his own earlier opinion. Like, why do you think he maintains that? Like, why doesn't he want to fully commit to this, I guess?
Well, two things. One, I think, you know, you got to keep Austin Matthews happy. You got to make him think. And I think it will happen that eventually he's going to get Marner back on his line. That's his favorite guy to play with. So I think that's number one. And number two, there's 50-some games left. Like, this could hit a lull, too. It's a long haul. So I think you don't want to box yourself in and say, oh, no, this is what we're going with. You know, I think you have to have an open mind. I remember that one game. A home game that Buffalo was in town Saturday night, and halfway through the first period, maybe not even, Matthews and Nylander were getting caved in by the Tage Thompson line, and immediately Keefe recognized that and made the switch for defensive reasons and reunited Marner with Matthews because he figured Marner's a more responsible winger than Nylander. I mean, those are my words, not Keefe's words, but basically he made it for defensive reasons. If we can shut down the Tage Thompson line, basically that's the only Buffalo line that's going to score on us. So to win tonight's game, I need Matthews and Marner, my best two defensive forwards, on them, and that'll free up Tavares and Nylander. What do you know? Tavares and Nylander connect for a goal in that game, and they win. And it was a really smart coaching decision, and afterwards Austin Matthews went out of his way to praise that adjustment, partly because I think he recognized that was a good coach's adjustment, but partly because, hey, I got to play, you know, 7/8 of a game with my buddy Mitch. So there's always that lurking in the background, I think.
We're speaking with Luke Fox, and check out his new article on sportsnet.ca, how Maple Leaf Sheldon Keefe is jamming it to all his critics. So he's been able to make some magic happen with some of these players, but what do you think his next project is? Is it Kerfoot? Is it Engvall? Is it trying to find a way for Robertson to really make an impact on this lineup consistently? Where is he going to direct his attention to next?
Well, when you're knocking him down from an A to an A-, I think Nick Robertson is part of that conversation, because I get it. You want to win every game, and Pontus Holmberg, who no one had really penciled into their lineup coming into this season, has been a really nice development in terms of a guy a coach can trust, a natural center. That was an issue with the team. They kind of cycled through a bunch of wingers at that 3C position, but Pontus has kind of settled things down. The coach likes him. Like, Keith went out of his way to say that you can't find a mistake in his game when you review the tape. And then you toss in the fact that the guy has a couple goals already, and he kind of looks like sound money as a six-round pick. But the emergence of Pontus Holmberg, the way Dennis Malgin was playing pretty strongly in the beginning, has kind of pushed Nick Robertson to the sideline. Now, he gets back in tonight, but I question the handling of this guy, because he's supposed to be your most promising prospect at forward that you have in the system. And he's in one night, he's out two nights, he's in three nights, he's out four or five nights. Like, I don't know how Robertson is supposed to find his game. And it's this balance of the coach wanting to dress the most responsible lineup versus we need to put this kid in a position to succeed. And how does he succeed? By scoring goals. I mean, that's his greatest attribute, is he's got the hardest shot on the team. Even Austin Matthews will tell you that. Maybe not the most accurate shot, but the hardest shot. So it's a bit of a head scratcher, because the more he sits, you wonder if you're stalling his development. You wonder if you're potentially diminishing an interesting trade asset if you don't think this is the guy for you. So it's been tricky. It's been a tricky balance. But to me, you have enough good players on the team. You have enough cushion in the standings that I'd like to see him get a decent run, not in and out every other night. I think he needs a bit of run to give him a chance to find his game. So we'll see. Maybe he gets it, because Dennis Malgin seems to be on a bit of a dip, and maybe Robertson can seize that spot starting tonight.
Let's wrap with this, Luke, and a little bit more big picture. Just wondering if you could juxtapose the Keefe that first arrived with the one that's coaching the Maple Leafs right now.
Yeah, I think the most telling thing is, one, the offense has dipped, but the defense has soared. They're way more responsible as a team defensively. And I think part of that is the players buying in, but part of it, I think Sheldon Keefe's priority has changed. And I think that's because he's been a fantastic regular season coach. He's always been able to get these guys to gather points, but he's been out-coached by more defensively minded coaches in three playoff series. And I think that has clicked. And I think now he's coaching in the regular season as a dress rehearsal for the playoffs. He's trying to get the team to clog up the middle, to block more shots. Their shot blocking in the Keefe era has never been as high as it is right now. It's over 15 per 60. That's a massive jump. He's getting the guys to play more playoff style hockey, because that's where, in my mind, he has been at his worst as a coach. Going up against more experienced guys, for sure. Pretty tough competition in John Cooper and John Tortorella, right? Like, but he has been outcoached on the defensive end, and now he's getting his guys to buy in defensively in preparation for where he's ultimately going to be judged and where his players are going to ultimately be judged.
That's Luke Fox. That's our piranha, not my words. We appreciate the time, Luke, and everyone should check out his latest on Sheldon Keefe. It's a great read.
All right. Have a great day, guys. Enjoy the game. Thanks.
Appreciate it, Luke. before we get to something to chew on, just a reminder, get your Wake and Rake submissions in. Let's go two for our last two.
Let's start a hot streak.
Is a message for myself. Let's make sure that we don't blow it again
it's in the end
afternoon.
Of November. It's your last chance to get me to donate some November money. Every win, $5, just $5. Every Wake and Rake, I double it. Last night was great. We had some listeners add to the November donations. So keep it up. Keep it up.
Definitely. Let's get to something to chew on, brought to you by Great Canadian Meats.
Yum, yum, yum. Our buddy John Morosi, he emerges like a phoenix from the ashes to give us more Blue Jays content, as always. We're top of mind for John Morosi.
Always.
He's thinking about his person at 590 The Fan when he makes these comments on MLB Network. A little bit of a stirring between some catchers that could be on the move.
The old log jam.
The log
Clearing
jam.
The log jam.
John Morosi says the following on MLB Network.
Two big names jump out. Danny Jansen in Toronto, Sean Murphy in Oakland. We know the A's certainly are in a trade mode. Murphy is out there and available, one of the very valuable young catchers in the game, still with 3 years of control left. There's some healthy interest in him. I would also say on the Cardinals side with Jansen, I have to credit Katie Wu of The Athletic. She had a really good point about how potentially a Jansen and Cardinals deal could come together when you consider the Cardinals' depth of young outfielders. Of course, Toronto moved Teoscar to the Seattle Mariners. There's now a spot for potentially a lefty bat in the outfield in Toronto now. And Katie made the point, Danny Jansen for Lars Nootbaar is a really good fit. You would say on both sides. You may have some issues where perhaps it's not exactly full value for value, but that's pretty darn close. And it's often hard at the trade market to find fit for fit, especially among two teams that believe they're contenders. I think that on both sides, Jansen for Nootbaar, when you consider how productive Nootbaar was towards the second half of the season in St. Louis, that's a pretty good fit on both sides. And I wouldn't be surprised at all if we saw something like that come to fruition there during the winter meetings next week.
All I got to say is Lars Nootbaar might be in the top echelon of names.
It's definitely in the top echelon.
I would love to be cheering for Lars Nootbaar, but
I don't have any Nootbaar takes, do you?
I don't want to get rid of Danny Jansen. Like talked about
this. Yeah, that's my take too.
About, what was it, maybe a month and a half ago when we're looking at the catchers, the surplus or the log jam. I really like Danny Jansen on this roster.
Yeah, I like the most important statistic when he's in the lineup, which is W's more often than not.
W's.
I don't think there's any, I'm willing to concede a little bit, a lot actually, from an offensive perspective with my catcher. If he's calling the game, that results in wins. It is the most important thing. And if the other guys can do the same, that's fine. But if they can't help out these pitchers the way that they need to be, if they can't call the game the way it needs to be, then you are opening yourself up to a problem that's kind of like not really seen. It's not like evident, but it exists. And I worry about that if you let go of Danny Jansen.
There was other Blue Jays rumors yesterday, but touch on that later in the show. You have to stay tuned. Maybe someone joining the Blue Jays coaching staff. But we're going to take a break because we got Josh Cloke calling in from Qatar. He had maybe the best assignment as a writer that I have ever seen in my life. That's next on the Fan Morning Show. Justin and Naylor, Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Big opinions and in-depth conversations covering the Leafs, Jays, Raptors, and the NFL. The J.D. Bunkus Podcast. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, we're back on the Fan Morning Show, Sportsnet 590 Fan. Big day in World Cup action today, as Justin teed up in our certainty soccer read. But tomorrow, Canada ends their their end of their World Cup in general with a game against Morocco, 10 a.m. right after the show. You just grab another espresso, Justin. You stay up, you watch it, and that's it for them. But we just got some, I guess, Herdman and co are on the podium chatting right now to the media. Here is an interesting quote. Herdman says after the Belgian loss,
Thierry Henry.
Is that their coach?
I don't know if it's their coach, but he's like...
He's in there.
Famous striker.
Comes up to him and said, Belgium should have lost. And Herdman says, quote, that's everything we dream of as a team, end quote.
And as our producer, Daniele, points out, this is more than handshake line territory. This is an embarrassing quote.
It's everything we dream of.
This might have been what John Herdman dreamed of when he grew up watching Thierry Henry and Arsenal and all that. This might be your dream, but our dream as Canadian soccer fans, that Canadian team, do they dream about being told, hey, we should have won that game?
You should have won, and
here's your consolation prize. That's what they dreamed of, the consolation prize?
Oof.
This is bad, and this goes back to what we've been saying, or what we've been wondering, pondering, mm-hmm. kind of worried about, that John Herdman's having a brutal World Cup. I can't spin it better than that.
This is your last media availability, probably. Maybe, well, obviously, post-game you'll have one.
Yeah, I guess the other one, the post-game matters.
The next one will be post-game about what happens with you in Morocco. You're not going to be asked, like, you know, how's this whole experience been, most likely. And this is the quote, everything we dream of as a team, for the other team to tell us that we were good. And we should beat them.
To be fair, I liked... the we're going to F Croatia attitude. I kind of liked it. I liked it more.
This is the polar opposite of that.
I liked it more. Yeah, it is. I liked it more believing that that could be true. But all told, and we're going to invite Josh Kloak into the conversation now, who just tweeted that quote from John Herdman. What do you make of Herdman saying that Thierry Henry came up to and told him that they should have won the Belgium match, and that's, quote, everything we dream of as a team?
Well, yeah, I mean, that was obviously part of what he said as a longer answer. But, I mean, those are compliments that you don't often get on the world stage when you're going to your first World Cup in 36 years. I mean, I think it's fair to say John Herdman and the Canadian team probably have multiple dreams, right? And,
I hope
you know,
so.
I should clarify. He listed, you know, because we know that they won't be making it out of the group stage. He was very clear today, you know, some of the team's goals going into this tournament were to be the first Canadian team to get out of the group, the first Canadian team to get a result, the first Canadian team to score a goal. And, you know, obviously they won't be able to accomplish all of those goals. But I think, you know, being able to just garner the respect of the football, you know, world at large, I think that's a big part of this Canadian team's mission. Because look, I got a number of questions, you know, in the first few days here in Qatar, just being like, what's it actually like? You know, what is soccer actually like in Canada? Do you have a league? What does it look like? So there's a lot of curiosity that I think veered, you know, on people kind of looking down at Canada. So for John Herdman to say that Thierry Henry, you know, one of the best forwards of all time, gave him that kind of compliment, I think what he was trying to reinforce is just, look, all things being equal, we play that game again, we probably get the result that we want, and we're not talking about Canada playing Morocco in not a meaningless game, but a game in which the result for Canada doesn't matter for the knockout stages, right?
Okay, that's fair, and there's obviously more context, and it's kind of Kipper territory. I don't know if you saw that yesterday, but like, there's more to it, and that's all fair. And maybe it's not completely handshake line territory with Sheldon Keefe after last year's loss to the Tampa Bay Lightning, although it seems kind of similar. However, I do want you to evaluate John Herdman, because we don't feel like it's necessarily been a brilliant World Cup appearance for him. There have been mistakes. There have been good things. How would you just sum up his performance here on the world stage and everything that's gone into the storyline, which has been John Herdman?
Yeah, I would evaluate his performance as probably fair, you know, maybe not good, but certainly fair. But again, like you just mentioned this, like, context is important. Like, if this were John Herdman's third World Cup, men's World Cup in a row, you know, and the team was eliminated after 2 days, it's a poor kind of performance. But listen, the gap between a CONCACAF team, and I have to clarify that, yes, the United States got out of their group last night, just barely. But the gap, what I've seen is the gap between CONCACAF teams and, frankly, the rest of the world is massive, right? It's great that Canada, you know, got or finished top of the group in CONCACAF. But this was a whole new kind of this was just a whole new game. So I think we're dealing with a team that is, you know, essentially rookies here. In terms of, like, the good and the bad, again, they should have gotten a result against Belgium. And you don't get a result against Belgium unless you plan and prepare your players for the way that they did play. Where John Herdman's performance kind of lacks, to me personally, is tactically what happened against Croatia. And talking to a few players after the game, it was pretty clear that they felt, and this isn't by no means, I've got to be clear, by no means am I saying there's a divide between coach and players, but what I think they saw is that Croatia adapted to Canada's game plan, you know, about 20 minutes in, and then Canada weren't able to kind of counter-adapt, if that makes sense, right? They didn't have a plan B, C, or D. So I think tactically, John Herdman was a little bit exposed as maybe not having the best preparation for a really, really smart team like Croatia. But, you know, it's two games, right? These are how small the margins in the World Cup are. So I certainly think moving forward, the next stage of John Herdman's evolution is, as, you know, this men's team's head coach, if he does stay until 2026, the brotherhood and the culture, that's set in place. What he needs to do is study the best tacticians around the world and make sure that come 2026, Canada is prepared to deal with some of the smartest teams in the world on the pitch specifically, right?
Before we get into your article that you posted yesterday about Alphonso Davies, which was great, and we'll dive into that. If we're going to give Herdman kind of an evaluation, I know it's only two games so far, but you know, it's they're almost done their time at the World Cup. What about Canada as a whole? Their return to the World Cup, obviously high anticipation, excitement. They haven't done what they had kind of set out as a goal yet, which is get a result or advance throughout the first round. But can this still be a success, this World Cup? Is it a success in your perspective? And how much of that is riding on what they do tomorrow against Morocco?
Honestly, a lot is riding on it tomorrow. I know some of my colleagues have said it's the game doesn't matter. The World Cup is over. I disagree because this is a Morocco team that needs, you know, a win or a draw to get out of the group. And so if Canada can, and like you guys know, if after you're eliminated, it's hard to get up for a performance. It can be hard to get up for a bronze medal game. And I think that's why I kind of like Canada's chances, because John Herdman has motivated, you know, the Canadian women's team in the past to win two bronze medals, games that are very difficult for players to kind of get up for. So if you can go into that game tomorrow and you could be the first Canadian team to get a draw, maybe even get a win, keep a clean sheet, you know, maybe get two goals, that is important because that shows that there's a little bit of, you know, mental resilience in this team. And look, it's interesting. I had the chance to ask John Herdman about 15, 20 minutes ago. You know, I said, when you look at this World Cup, you look bigger picture, what's something that maybe you saw in another team, in another federation that made you go, oh, I want that. I want Canada to do that. And the thing that he basically said is the ability to close out games, show creativity in the final third, and just hammer it down and get the result, because that's what they weren't able to do against Belgium. So if you can go into that Morocco game and you can close out the game, you can get a 1-1 draw, you can get a 2-1 win. I mean, that just shows improvement day to day. And I think, you know, in a World Cup, that's what you want, right?
We're talking with Joshua Cloke, who's in Qatar. He's a soccer and Maple Leafs writer for The Athletic and author of The Voyageurs. As Ailish alluded to, that you wrote about Alphonso Davies yesterday. The title of that piece in The Athletic is Alphonso Davies scored Canadian men national team biggest goal ever, but what comes next is bigger. And I think in it you touch on what is kind of a surprising storyline here, which is the sudden referendum that I see, at least, on Davies' character, Alphonso Davies' leadership ability. Tell us how it actually is, because it seems like everyone's making opinions based on, you know, limited information, how he fits into the system, what he what he means, what he stands for. What makes Alphonso Davies tick, and what does the Canadian men's national team, in your opinion, mean to him?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I appreciate the shout out. Mine isn't the Alphonso Davies story everyone is reading today, but that's okay. Look, I think Alphonso Davies has had kind of an up and down World Cup. I think he was okay against Belgium. And I think for those 20, 25 minutes where Canada was in control against Croatia, I thought he was fantastic. Alphonso Davies has a tendency at times to kind of play hero ball and take the team on his back. But, like, you know, when you are the most gifted player of the team, that's a license that you're afforded. Now, in terms of you know, Alphonso Davies' character, I genuinely hope my piece isn't being viewed as a hit on his character at all. I think Alphonso Davies simply has an opportunity here to become the true voice of this team. We know he's the face. We know he's probably the closest thing we have to a household name. But look, there's going to be an exodus, and that's what I saw. I saw the likes of Atiba Hutchinson and Stephen Vitoria, you know, speaking for this men's team in the media a lot. And to date, you know, that the written media, we've only spoken to Alphonso Davies once. My understanding is just there's just continued dialogue between Davies people and Canada Soccer, and people that just want to make sure that Davies is kind of presented in the best manner. Like, you look at what Tyler Adams, the 23-year-old U.S. captain, he had to answer questions about, you know, whether he wants to play for the United States, given, you know, the country's long history of racism. You had Greg Berhalter, the U.S. coach, answering questions about, you know, naval ships in Iran. Like, those are not the kind of questions Alphonso Davies wants to deal with. So I think there was a lot of concern about the image and making sure that he is presented in the right light. And I think the frustration from the media's perspective is that, you know, he's the team's best player, and he should have to answer, you know, good and bad. Because if Canada wants to go back to the World Cup every 4 years, these losses are going to continue. And look, I mean, it's no different. I think, like, am I wrong in saying that, like, if the best player on the team should have to answer for the team? And it just doesn't feel like Alphonso Davies maybe, I don't know, wants to take that jump. And that's fair. Maybe he doesn't, right? That the best player on the team isn't necessarily the captain. But what I do sense here is there's some confusion as to why, when Canada is finally on, you know, the biggest stage, the stage they've always wanted to be at, why their kind of star player hasn't been put out in front of the media more. I think that's the confusion that a lot of people are kind of discussing today, right?
Well, yeah, there's clearly something there, and people are taking a different approach to it, and I don't suggest that yours is at all a hit piece, but maybe just, you know, laying out the fact that there is still growth here. This is this generational player. This is one of the best fullbacks in the world. This guy could be going to Bayern, to Real Madrid. I mean, we're talking about the biggest clubs in the world, and he represents Canadian soccer more than anyone, but that doesn't mean that he's not responsible for more internal growth and development and maturation and becoming an even better player than he is by not focusing on what's on the pitch, by being more of a leader or whatever. So where does he have to improve to be the guy that can lead success for Canada in the future?
I mean, we're veering on to, you know, psychology 101 here, but, like, it might just be a case of the person just becoming more comfortable in their own skin, right? And I compared him to Tyler Adams, who, again, is 23 years old and who is just a remarkably poised, mature person. And like, some people, you know, grab that right away. We all know, like, mature 15-year-olds, and, you know, some people are not. And that's no kind of fault of Alphonso. Like, I don't know if he loves doing media, but I think just being it, because his story, this is what gets me, and I mean this, his story is so emblematic of this entire Canadian team, right? It's a rags to riches story. He represents all that's good about this Canadian team, a player of color, a refugee, a player that, you know, got an opportunity here in Canada and completely ran with it. And there's so many players on this team like that. And I think this Canadian team keeps talking again and again and again about how they want to inspire the next generation of Canadian players. And to do that, you have to be more comfortable, you know, telling your story. I don't know how comfortable Alphonso Davies is yet continually answering questions. So perhaps it's just a matter of that, getting out in front of the cameras more, talking more, and just becoming, you know, comfortable and understanding that, like, as a media, this is the thing too. I know I'm going on here, but I mean this. Like, there's not a lot of Canadian media here covering this team. And we genuinely all wanted to write very positive stories because it's a historic, momentous occasion. No one was preparing to have to write, whoa, what happened here after two games, right? We all came in thinking this would be a chance to tell a lot of great stories. So I think maybe there needs to be an understanding that the way the media acts in Germany, in Europe, is not the same the way that maybe the media acts in Canada. And a lot of people just want to tell stories, right?
Yeah, and I think we should underscore the point that if Alphonso Davies is just Alphonso Davies, that's a great thing. Like, with, and it's a thing that should continue to be celebrated. But it is okay to want more. It's okay to feel like there is more. And there's okay to be a little bit critical if it doesn't go the way that it's all planned or what the expectations might be.
Well, and I wrote this in the piece. Like, everything now, everything is pointed towards 2026. Right. And the bigger question here is Canada ready? Is Canada ready to host? Is Canada ready to get out of the group? You know, are these players ready to take the next step? And I think that's just the question I was trying to ask in the piece. And it's the question that I am genuinely wondering, right? What is Alphonso Davies' role in this team going to be in 2026? Right. Not every player can be, you know, Tyler Adams, incredibly composed on and off the pitch. Some of them can. Is that what Alphonso Davies wants? I asked him, you know, do you want to be the captain of this team? And he said, I don't need the captain's armband to lead. And I thought that was one of the most revealing things, you know, he said. So I guess I'm wondering, too, what does his leadership style look like? Is he the type that, you know, I don't know if this comparison is super apt, but is he more of an Austin Matthews type that just kind of leads by example and by playing really well and hitting those highs, that inspires players to try and hit their highs as well. So we're just, like, you know, this whole time following this Canadian team, a lot of it is just figuring it out. I mean that. Like, I'll be honest, I didn't expect to have to write, you know, what the hell happened to Canada after two games. That was a kind of a difficult story to write. We're all just kind of figuring it out here. The Germanys, the Englands of the world, they know the routine. So this is all part of it, just figuring things out step by step, right?
Josh, on a fun, positive note to let you go, I teed it up that you might have had the best assignment to ever be presented to a writer. You wrote that you were in search of beer in Doha. You got to go find the spots in Qatar that you could booze. And I want to know about your experience in general there. Where does Qatar get it right? Have we been, you know, been fed the most accurate information about the party scene and the enjoyment levels that you can have at the World Cup?
Yeah, that's a great question. you know, I'm glad that I was one of the first Canadian journalists to get here. I came straight from Dubai after Canada's friendly, and I was here for a few days before the World Cup started, you know, and the games come fast and heavy. So I had some time to kind of kick around, and it just feels like, first of all, like nearly every single place to find beer is in a hotel. So, you know, the atmosphere isn't exactly super authentic. My hotel doesn't have a bar, but it just feels like a lot of the bars that I've been to, and I wrote this in the story, you know, these hotels would have just Googled bar, and the first image they find is the way that they're going to design these bars. Like, you know, going to, you know, the creatively named Irish pub Doha, like you walk in there and it's just like it looks exactly like it sounds. What I found is that it's the places in Doha that like don't try to be anything, right? The swanky places that I've gone to go overboard, too swanky, right? And it's overbearing. The generic pubs just literally seem like facsimiles of, you know, TGI Fridays. It's the places that don't try to be anything. The place that all of us at The Athletic hang out is a bar that literally just has open cement walls and four big TVs and two kinds of beer. Those, to me, are the best places to go. You can find beer in Doha. It's expensive. which I suppose makes you appreciate it a little bit more. But I will not be remembering this. This World Cup has been incredible, and I know I've been going on and on. This has been, you know, a once in a lifetime experience for me. But what I won't specifically remember are the nights out, if that makes sense.
Will you be headed home after Thursday's match, or are you staying for most of the remaining weeks or days or games?
I'm here through the round of 16, even though my wife and my four-year-old son have, you know, they're probably asking the embassy to find me and bring me back right away. But, you know, no, I'm here for the round of 16 games. And look, I mean, the World Cup being in Qatar is a completely other discussion that, that other people cover very, very well. But there's been some tremendous soccer so far, and you know, I look forward to seeing more of that and covering more of that. And also, to be honest, like looking at these teams, looking at these programs and saying, what can Canada learn from all of this? Because in a lot of ways, it was a fact-finding mission for Canada. And I hope to kind of look at some of these teams and say, wow, could Tejon Buchanan be that guy? Could Jonathan David be that guy? How do they get to the next step? Because it's all pointed towards 2026, right?
For sure. We appreciate you coming on this morning or afternoon over there. And we'll keep an eye on what else comes at The Athletic from you post Canada's action and the rest of the World Cup. And have a beer on us. We'll send you Qatar money. I don't know how it works, but we'll appreciate it, Josh. And we'll talk with you after everything ends.
That would absolutely bust up your expense account for the month, I assure you.
All right. Thanks so much.
No. Thanks so much, guys. Yeah.
We just got to hit a couple more waking rakes, then
we
send him a new transfer or whatever.
I think Josh is very beyond fair almost. Mm-hmm. I think I have all the respect in the world for him. But there is certainly something going on where everybody there covering Canada is wanting more from
perplexed.
Alphonso Davies, right? Mm-hmm. Like that is pretty much the only thing we're hearing, whether it's said one way or said the other way, they want a little bit more from him. I think it's okay to want more from someone who has given you a lot. I think it's okay.
Just like we want more from Austin Matthews.
Sometimes we want more. We want playoff success. We want him to do it on the playoff stage. I think that's all fine. I think I am having trouble with this, but I think if I'm going to like distill my thoughts into one thing very, very quickly here as we got to get to break, is that I think we've showed our inexperience here, and he mentioned it, in all ways. Alphonso Davies has shown his inexperience at this tournament. John Herdman has done that. I think our media has done it. I think the team has done it. I think the fans have done it. I think in all ways, we have shown to a small degree that we are first-timers, if that makes sense. And I think that includes Alphonso Davies, and because he's at the forefront of everything, along with John Herdman, those are the two that get most of the attention when showing that inexperience.
You got one more day of on-pitch performance to prove that you know, they have made some steps forward, maybe, and then I'm sure the post-media will be interesting to see wrap it up.
This was a necessary step.
100%. They got four years to
rookie
keep.
Lumps, it happens.
Rookie lumps. All right, let's take a break. We'll talk to Will Liu after the break, host of the Raptors show. Your Toronto Raptors are almost back to full health. How does he evaluate the time in between that and what to look forward to when they're back in action tonight, actually. All right, that's next on the Fan Morning Show, Sportsnet 590 The Fan.